The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Ronald Heifetz. Professor Heifetz co-founded the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He is well known for developing transformative methods of leadership education and development. His courses at the Kennedy School have consistently been voted the most influential by the school's alumni. He advises heads of government, business, and non-for-profit organizations around the world. He is the author and co-author of many books, including Leadership on the Line, Staying Alive Through the Dangers of Change. Ron Heifetz, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you, Kelly.
You wrote a new post-election preface for Leadership on the Line, and this quote really stuck out to me. You write, quote, "Acting politically, then, requires deep empathy, understanding the story people are telling themselves and you, even if you think that story is foolish, so that you can meet them where they are instead of where you are." And we have a phrase in improvisation, which is play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. And I'm just sort of curious what lessons in leadership you think we're getting right now in the political environment.
Great question. And I love the metaphor from improvisation. Earlier in my career, I grew up playing classical music, playing the cello. But then for part of my career later, I used to improvise with a improvisational dance company.
Oh, wow.
It kept my spirit going through medical school. And so I've thought a lot about improvisation and how it how key elements of leadership are in improvisational art. Mm. Many people want to believe that leadership's about knowing where you're going and defining the critical path to get there. And the rest of it is basically just a sales job of selling people on it and keeping people on that course. Hmm. But that's not actually the way leadership works, particularly in the context of the kinds of tough challenges that we're facing in our society today. Most tough challenges, you may have an abstract idea where you'd like to arrive, which is greater prosperity, more jobs, more peace, you know, more social justice. But how you actually get there on any programmatic front, how you actually improve the school system or neighborhood tranquility is an improvisation. You have to have the presence to reassess moment after moment where are you now, so that you can then take corrective action. And that capacity to constantly step back on the balcony, mm-hmm. get off the playing field, get off the dance floor, and reflect on where am I now so that you can then figure out how to move next is one of the critical skills of leadership.
Yeah.
So where are we now? Where are we now in our country, you're mm-hmm. at?
Yes.
Well, I think we've dug ourselves into a deep hole.
Yeah.
I think we've dug ourselves into a really deep hole, because it's been now several cycles, or you could even say at least one or two generations, in which people have been given enormous grants of political authority. That is, people have entrusted them with power, mm-hmm. but in exchange to provide services. Because the essence of any authority or authorizing relationship is that I vote for you, but I expect you to deliver services, and I'm giving you this trust, and I'm trusting myself over to you, you know, but giving you all this power that the government is able to mobilize. I'm giving you that power. I expect you to deliver services, and people feel deeply, deeply outraged because they feel betrayed. It's not just that they're afraid of tomorrow. The dominant emotion, I do not think, is fear. I think the dominant emotion is anger. And the anger is generated by a feeling of betrayal, not simply a fear of loss into the future. I mean, obviously, that's an element. But I think that the damage to our institutions and the damage to our democracy has been caused by the corrosion of trust in authority. Mm-hmm. As people have been given grants of authority and then betrayed the trust of that authority by overpromising over and over again, overpromising and underdelivering. And it's a deep problem in a democracy because at every election cycle, it's a lot easier to promise services rather than to confront people with the reality of change in the economic system, to confront people with the requirement they're going to have to pay more taxes, that they're going to have to pitch in, that they're going to have to sometimes take sacrifice. It's much easier to sell services than it is taxes at every, with every election cycle. And so we tend to dig ourselves into a deeper hole of deficit, and not just financial deficits, you know, but also deficits of trust.
It's interesting because the way you're framing this, I did not expect. Because so one of the things we talk about in improvisation is the biggest enemy of improvisation is fear. We know when people are in their fear brain, they can't improvise. But that's actually, you can solve that. And what we have right now, which feels unsolvable, I hope it isn't. I think you strike at the root of it when you say no, betrayal, which is a much deeper and thornier thing than simply fear, and very hard, I would imagine, to undo.
Yes. In fact, betrayal is mobilizing, and we've seen a lot of people get out there and get engaged. In some sense, that's a success, because you want in a democracy, you want more engagement. If we're only fear, many people would cower and would be resigned, would feel hopeless, would feel despairing. They'd stay home. They wouldn't engage. Anger is, at least it's mobilizing. That's the benefit of it. But the downside of it is that sometimes people's judgment, when they're caught up in the rage of betrayal, their judgments are poor, and they are less discriminating as they yearn for somebody and become vulnerable to somebody who provides powerful expression of their outrage. Mm-hmm. Here's the paradox. People develop over the years layers of skepticism, and then it finally becomes cynicism as they become less and less trusting of politicians, which means less and less trusting of people in political authority. And the problem is that, or maybe the hope is that, or the beauty of humanity is that even deep beneath those layers of distrust, of skepticism, and then cynicism, deep below those layers is a pool of innocence, a pool of the still alive yearning. Just like a child continues to yearn and hope that an abusive parent will finally love them right.
All right.
There is the deep yearning that some politicians will emerge who will be worthy of the trust. And the deep irony, and in some sense the tragedy of our moment, is that deep yearning to find somebody to trust has been aggrandized or taken advantage of, exploited by a political charlatan.
Yeah,
and I think it's going to be enormously painful for people who felt betrayed cycle after cycle by politicians who overpromise. It's going to be extremely difficult for people to finally realize that they've been conned. You know, that they've been conned and sold another bill of goods.
So
my fear is that that's going to further damage the democracy, because you can't have a working democracy without building the quotient of trust in the society,
right,
rather than continuing to corrode it.
Right. So it's interesting. I hearken back to a moment when I was producing at Second City, and this is when Obama was just running, right, and was still
right.
still in the primary. And we knew, you know, I'm from Chicago, and we knew each other, and not a great deal.
Right.
But we ended up creating a show called Between Barack and a Hard Place that was this huge
hit.
And
yeah, I bet.
The central idea in the show that the cast sort of came up with, and, you know, we write our shows in conversation with the audience, so we ask for suggestions, and then so it's very sort of organically developed. But the idea with this was that everyone on stage played Barack Obama at some point during the show, because the thesis was everyone is seeing themselves in this person, and it is not realistic.
Yes.
And I do feel like that if you're looking for seeds of Trump, and I'm not blaming anyone for this, that there is something in the water then that we were as a collective country were looking for, and we thought we found it potentially, or individuals thought they found it in this, and now they've transferred to something which seems so radically different. But then you find out all the people who voted for Bernie, who voted for Trump, and you're like, no, I mean, it's not about ideology anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with what you all portrayed and what you discovered in your improvisational group playing Barack, because it's extremely difficult for a politician to give people bad news.
Yeah,
it's dangerous. It's politically dangerous. So there's the art of engaging people in news that they don't want to hear. The idea that it's going to take years rather than months. Mm-hmm. Or that they're going to have to change and learn new skills. I was speaking with a former governor of Michigan on a panel over the weekend. We had a conference of hundreds of people working on people who do leadership that build from the framework that my colleagues and I have developed called adaptive leadership. And one of my former students from early years is the former governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm.
Oh, yeah.
And she talked about how when she came to office in 2003, it was 5 years before the big meltdown in 2008. Mm-hmm. But the beginnings of the disintegration of the auto industry was already in play. Mm-hmm. And she describes a year into her tenure as governor that this wasn't going to be just another cycle. You know, the community was well accustomed to cycles, and they knew how to buffer the pain during a down cycle with the hope that it was going to turn around. Mm. And they were used to those cycles. They knew how to, they were acclimated to those cycles. They were adapted to that. But she discovered a year and a half that this wasn't a cycle. This was a structural flaw, and that there were many jobs that were not coming back. And that the structure of the auto industry itself and the structure of labor union relations was itself deeply problematic and needed to change. And the pain was not going to go away fast. In fact, the pain was going to continue to get worse. And the challenge then was for a lot of workers to get reeducated and develop new skills. The challenge for industries was for the government, and she was extraordinary in this regard, was to fly all over the world persuading companies to locate themselves in Michigan, to build from the best of Michigan's industrial talent and capacity new industries, mm-hmm. like electric batteries or electric cars. But for a lot of people, then that meant there was going to be a need to change and readjust their lives and go through a sustained period of painful, you know, adjustment. And she describes in her first State of the Union, State of the State speech, that she wanted to tell people, or at least begin to bring people into the reality of what they were facing and up mm-hmm. against. But all of her handlers told her, don't do it.
Right.
People want, all they want is hope from you. Mm-hmm. They don't want any sobering realities from you. Mm. And, you know, maybe that's right in a particular State of the State speech. But if a politician continues to give people, you know, rosy messages, over time, reality catches up with you. You know, and you find yourself improvising yourself right into a corner.
Yeah. Well, and this is what's fascinating, too, about this book, because you don't downplay the dangers of leadership. You talk about very specifically, especially in a great, you know, period of change like what's happening. But what I think you, what I surmised was that your solution set digs into our most basic humanity. It's like we just need to look at ourselves and what makes us actually very human to understand what some solutions might be. I mean, this is like the only leadership business book that I know that talks about sex in a very sort of specific way that I'm like, that's smart. Because it does, especially in the areas of power and leadership. And look, we're coming off of this Harvey Weinstein, you know, scandal,
right,
which is directly about that, about how people use sex. And I'm like, it belongs in a business book. And when you can think about sex and you talk about love, and you talk about Sacred Heart, and these are things that, you know, are anathema or have been to so much of the ideas around leadership or business that you don't talk about, but you get right at it.
Yeah, because my heart goes out to people who actually got the courage to go out there and try to tackle the world's toughest problem. Mm-hmm. From the most micro level of a family or a neighborhood or a classroom to the more macro levels of a community or a whole neighborhood or a city, or an industry, or a business, or let alone a country. My heart goes out to people who really have good hearts, are trying to do good things, but get mangled in the process of trying to gauge people in working the toughest problems.
Yeah.
Because you see, the fundamental habit of in humanity is to look to authorities to solve problems. And we do that from the moment we're born, because we're all born totally helpless.
Yeah.
And we're all born designed to trust. You know, you hold a baby in your arms, and the baby just melts in your chest. Hmm. The baby's designed to trust. The baby's designed to give his or her life over to the elder, expecting, of course, services. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is designed. Life, social life is designed through evolutionary time to create relationships of trust in which people from childhood as they grow up look to elders, they look to authorities, and they say the implicit bargain is, I entrust you, I look to you, and I trust you with power over my body, over my future, over my education. You know, I'm lost in this school, tell me where the bathroom is. Mm-hmm. You know, we entrust elders. And we entrust them to provide us with services. And that relationship, that reciprocal relationship of, you know, one person empowers another person, entrusts their power to another person in exchange for services. That essential authority relationship, authorizing relationship, is built into us, and it starts from the moment we're born. So that by the time you're 20 years old, each of us have had thousands of moments of life in which elders have actually done the job well. Hmm. You ask somebody for help. You have a problem you need solved. You don't know how to solve a problem in fifth grade. You talk to your teacher, and they teach you how. And so by the time we're 20, we have a built-in habit of expecting authorities to deliver answers to our problems. Mm-hmm. And that system works great as long as the elders actually do have the solution.
Yeah.
But when the elders don't have the solutions, when the solutions actually require the people themselves to learn new ways, to change their ways, when the people actually are part of the problem, you know, like a patient comes to a doctor with heart disease and wants to be cured, wants to go back to their life. And the doctor may even be able to do a procedure, you know, like surgery, where they get new vessels. Mm-hmm. But even after that, only part of the problem's been solved, because the other hard part of the problem remains in the attitudes and habits of that patient. And if the patient doesn't change their diet, change their smoking, get exercise, change stress, then the odds of that doctor's handiwork succeeding for a very long time really go down.
Right.
Those arteries will clog up again if the patient doesn't do his or her part of the work. we have a whole host of problems in our community in which new capacity is required, where you don't get a solution just by looking to authorities to provide an expert remedy. There are a lot of problems that require the engagement of the people themselves, because the people are part of the problem, and therefore the people are the solution.
Yeah. It also, and it strikes me too, one of the things that we have lost in recent days, and maybe it's longer than that, is the ability to stay inside a difficult conversation.
Right.
That we are proud of blocking. Or
yes.
Defriending. We sort of like, well, look, they're gone to me. And really, when you think about, well, like, oh, that is terrible. You are basically giving up on another human being because of an encounter on a social media network where, you know, it's like road rage, right? It's who knows what they're clicking or what's going on. And it's funny, I talked recently with my friend Ashley Black, who's a correspondent and a writer for Sam B and Full Frontal, and she was the one who, she's a black woman, and she went to Trump's, to the, you know, inauguration, and she went to, you know, these events. And what she said is, yes, they would spit Sean Hannity talking points to me for 10 minutes, and by the end of our conversation, everyone hugged me. So she has a very charitable view of many Trump supporters, because she has actually met them, and she is constantly being berated online by people who haven't met any and aren't talking to them because they would prefer to see them en masse.
Yes. Yes, and what's most problematic is that we're getting this increased polarization, and I think the most essential thing in recurring trust is a sense of community in which people really make a much greater effort to bow their self-righteousness and their indignation and begin to listen to one another and create bridges across these divides and start hanging out in each other's homes and restaurants and neighborhoods. Because, you know, if it's just an echo chamber of people looking at the news they like and talking to the people who agree with them, then how are people going to learn new ways?
Yeah, yeah, and we share more. One of
the things we learned from nature in thinking about adaptive change is that new capacity in nature is formed by bringing differences together.
Hmm.
And that's what sexual reproduction is all about.
Yeah.
You bring two different sets of chromosomes together and you create this unique offspring. You know, and cloning is much, much less effective in evolution because you just don't get innovation.
Hmm.
But you bring differences together. And I think that, you know, people don't learn by staring in the mirror. People learn by engaging in a different point of view.
Right.
And the people who feel betrayed, who voted for Donald Trump, have a good reason to feel betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually more betrayed with their own Republican Party. Then they're more outraged with their own Republican Party, because in some ways the Republican Party, even more than the Democratic Party, but to some extent the Democratic Party too, has overpromised and underdelivered.
Hmm.
You know, the Republican Party for years promised smaller government, but every time they're in power, actually the government stays just as big or gets bigger.
Yeah.
They promise reduction of the deficit, but when they're in power, that's not what they do. They just spend it differently.
Hmm.
You know, they promise unleash the wealthy, and the wealth will trickle down, except it hasn't. So, you know, people have a good reason to be angry. Then they're vulnerable to charlatans who give them fake remedies. But we've got to listen to those legitimate grievances and not write people off because they're reaching for a solution that we don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to agree they're reaching for a solution that's going to bite them in the end. As we see, the new tax proposals are all about unleashing the wealthy again.
Yeah.
And it's not going to trickle down. And so people are going to continue to feel angry at them. But the problem, maybe the solution they've got isn't the right one. The people feel betrayed in supporting these right-wing candidates. But the pain they feel is very real. And the evolution of that sense of betrayal in false promises over many political cycles is also really legitimate. And I think we've got to bridge these divides by not arguing so much about the solutions that each of us propose, but instead by engaging each other in discussing the nature of these challenges and problems. And I think when we stick with the challenges, problems, and the pains, and can hang out longer in the creative thinking about, well, what can we do about it, rather than just locking horns on your solution versus mine, then I think it becomes easier to bridge and advise and to begin to restore a sense of community and collective effort.
And you, I was very fascinated when you talked about this idea around creating a holding environment. So one of the SOSR solution sets that we talk about here is this idea that you need to have, you know, holding environments. And as you were laying what this out is, I'm like, oh my God, this is literally the Second City main stage process that started in 1959, has not changed at all. So you talk about this protected physical space. You know, we have a thing when we're in rehearsals for a show in the main stage space, the owners, the producers, we actually need permission to enter. They are in there. Yeah. It is their sacred space. You talk about lateral bonds of shared language and common history. And everyone in our world is trained in improvisational pedagogy and has these ideas about saying yes and, making your partner look good, always playing on top of your intelligence. And then the clear sets of rules and processes that give minority voices the confidence that they would be heard without having to disrupt the proceedings to gain attention. And this is all about ensemble behavior and the idea that you're required to listen without judgment, and that that one voice is just as important as any other voice, and it becomes part of the whole group voice. And I really think when you think about those, you need to really think about sometimes physical spaces, but then you also think about behaviors, group behaviors, and individual behaviors. It's like you're taking all of it and sort of saying, God, look at how your business runs and see if you can't manufacture this.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's a beautiful metaphor because, in a sense, what required as we face into the adaptive challenges is the collective need to be able to improvise better.
Yeah.
Is to be able to see a new policy out of government, even a business policy, as an experiment, as an improvisational move, as a version 2.1. It's going to then require a 2.2 and a 2.3 and a 2.4.
Yeah.
You know, and if we had more of a sense of the ongoing adaptive process that we're all in whatever issue area or community area, it's going to require us to collectively being able to hold each other in an improvisation, in an ongoing set of adaptations, where our adaptability as a community to make it together rather than divide ourselves and fall apart, that ability to hold together as a community, that ensemble as a community, builds exactly from what you're describing in Second City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, literally, I say this to people all the time because we're so rare, which is Second City started in 1959, still going, has never not had a hit show. In its entire, I mean, we always have done, and it's always original work. That's unheard of in the contemporary theater.
Yeah.
And the only reason that works is because of these sort of structures, which it's kind of funny, too, because you think about the origin story, which comes out of the University of Chicago in the 50s, where certain kinds of thought, you know, economic thought and other thought, we're all sort of rising to create a sort of a modern way of thinking. And then we're sitting here today when Richard Thaler won the Nobel Prize. And you know that, I imagine, I don't know if you've thought about this, but you as a musician who has improvised with a dance company improvising, which is really sort of improvisation allows your system one and system two to work in concert back and forth. And I think improvisation is one of the few areas where that's sort of so at play on top.
Yes. And what improvisation is predicated on, particularly as a collective enterprise, you know, rather than a solo enterprise, is that you really trust one another.
Yes. You have to.
Because you trust that if you make a move and you wonder if it's a mistake, that somebody else is going to turn that move into not a mistake, because you're going to figure out a way to build from it.
Yep.
And, you know, and your move that kind of almost surprised you certainly surprised them. You know, it's their building from it and your ability to trust them that they're going to build from whatever you do that gives you then the freedom to experiment and the freedom to try version 2.1.1.
Yep.
Because you know they're going to build up from that. And that kind of collective sense that we're really in this together, and if the first, you know, if Obama's health care policy didn't work perfectly out of the box, that we're going to come together and we're going to fix it and we're going to improve it. And then we're going to have to improve it again. And we're going to have to continue improving it.
Right.
So you luckily have created a relationship with your audiences where they expect you to improvise. Unfortunately, our politicians have not created an expectation. They haven't renegotiated the social contract with their constituents so that the constituents understand that the politicians are also improvising.
Right.
But every one of their policy proposals is just today's next improvisational move.
Right.
From which we're then going to have to make the next move as we discover what works and what isn't working about it. Because in a changing world, you don't have permanent solutions.
It's so funny that that happened. I mean, because I feel like, I know not all businesses run like this, but it feels like the business community has caught up to this.
Many businesses have, but many businesses haven't.
I guess they haven't. But it is interesting, the way it's playing out politically is just so core opposite of the way it needs to.
Yes. I mean, you know, even in the automobile industry, which we discussed for a minute earlier, you know, you've had companies that have been extraordinarily adaptive, like Toyota, where no matter what the exchange rate is, no matter how the international marketplace has changed, no matter how tastes have evolved, they have been extraordinarily adaptive in reading the changes, in responding quickly, in experimenting widely with many different models, you know, with different kinds of labor practices, different kinds of factory practices, empowering the workers to provide improvement suggestions all the way up and down the line as a deep matter of culture, building a sense of trust and collaboration amongst the workers through a lot of, you know, through a lot of extracurricular activities like calisthenics, you know. Whereas compared to the American auto workers that required, you know, coming up against the wall. I mean, they had to smash into a terrible wall requiring the government to bail them out to finally realize that they required a great deal more adaptability. And I think that there is a wide spectrum of businesses that have more adaptive cultures or less adaptive cultures. And the ones with less adaptive cultures are not following some of the principles that you follow in your improvisational dance company.
Yeah.
You know, and therefore are much more at risk as the times change, because they can't read the changes quickly and respond to the changes quickly in people's tastes or economic conditions or international conditions. That responsiveness, moment to moment, that adventuresome, courageous ability to, you know, to live into an uncertain future with faith in yourself and faith in your comrades that we're improvising together and learning together into the future, and that when one of us falls down, we're gonna support one another and buffer those painful transitions together.
Right.
Is what you've been doing, and is what needs to be restored in the American experiment.
Yeah. And I don't know, before I could talk to you forever, and I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but before I do that, I have a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old, And I have some faith in these generations coming up, because my experience, at least with them and their friends and their communities, is they're highly adaptive. They're much better listeners. They really revel in each other's successes. And I know this is not true of every community, but I do, a certain ones that I've had a peer into, I feel very good about this generation. And I know a lot of people, you know, scream about the millennials coming into the workforce, but a lot of the ones that I work with are terrific and hardworking and want to change things, and the world has meaning for them and they believe in that. So I don't know what your experience is, because you teach young people all the time.
Well, you know, it's always risky to make huge generalizations about any group of people. You know, young people come in a lot of different varieties, and they're young people who come from cultures that have made them more self-confident and more trusting of one another, and other people who come from cultures that have been traumatized and betrayed, where as part of their upbringing, they learn to distrust and they learn to feel wary of depending on people around them. So there's a lot of aspects, but at least in my experience, young people are more improvisational and more... And in part, it's because most young people do believe that somebody has their back. Mm-hmm. You know, that there is an elder, there is a big brother, an aunt, an uncle, a parent, grandparent. There is a teacher, a coach. There's somebody who has their back, and therefore they take the risk of experimenting, of trying, of failing, of learning through trial and error over time. Mm-hmm. And people begin to lose that capacity as they begin to lose a sense that there's a backup system.
Right. That makes sense. Again, framing it with regard to youth always being sort of a little more improvisational in nature, and that does sometimes get educated out of us, or work takes it out of us, or you know, whatever, bad marriage, whatever. Yeah, okay, I got it.
Yes. But again, going to the principles of your troop, you know, it's that willingness to the deep knowledge that gets confirmed every evening that somebody is going to back you up with whatever stupid move you've happened to make, you know, and they'll turn it into something that's a brilliant new color in the tapestry rather than, you know, a stupid mistake.
Yep.
And, you know, you never know if it's a stupid mistake until you figure it out. And so you've seen how is it woven in over time.
Yeah,
And that depends on your buddies.
Yeah, no trust, no improv. You can't do it otherwise.
Right. And I think another thing that I think it would be great for you to talk about, if not now, then at other times, as you draw from your improv company's experience, is how do you repair trust? Because I'm sure that people end up hurting each other's feelings, making mistakes, stepping on each other's toes, getting out in front, you know, stealing the limelight in a stupid way, you know, losing, and we're trust frays. And it would seem to me, I'm just guessing, that there are reparative mechanisms, you know, habits in culture of repair. Mm-hmm. Built in, where people talk things through and get ready for the next get back into the game, and my guess is that there have even been at times failures of the reparative process where there have been some casualties.
Yep,
and I think it's been would be enormously useful to explore that, because where we are right now as a society is where, you know, we have to figure out how to recover trust.
Yeah,
we have to figure out, how do we repair the trust? And maybe your experience can give us some clues as a metaphor for what's needed in neighborhoods all over our country.
Well, you are touching on it when you tell the Chicago Bulls Phil Jackson, Scottie Pippen story.
Yeah,
and I mean I'm a Chicagoan. I am a huge basketball fan. That was this moment.
Right.
where, and is most of our audience is going to know it, where Scottie Pippen wasn't going to get the last shot, and he did not go on the court. And there's one thing in theater, you probably know this as a rule, you have to show up. There's no not showing up. And the other thing that inside an ensemble is, you know, you are with each other. We do 8 shows a week. And you, yes, people have done stuff on stage that's been bad. And part of the solution is the fact that they have to show up in front of that ensemble the next day. There's no not performing. And if I think of what the casualties are in our work, it's very few, but it always resulted in them not showing up, either by their choice or our choice. So this sort of forced, difficult conversation, the rules of the ensemble holding, and in this case, Phil Jackson stepped out of the room and let Bill Cartwright take it and let the ensemble heal itself, and that's an act of leadership. But sometimes also it is the director, who is our Phil Jackson, who comes in and says, I observed this. It felt wrong to me. Can you understand how that feels? So, indeed, I don't think I've ever thought about or framing it in the way that you've discussed, so I will give it some thought. But the idea of being able to repair trust is probably even more important, you know, now than ever. Because indeed, that's what we seem to be playing with.
Yes.
In the worst possible way.
Yeah, help us figure this out.
I'll work on it, man. All right, so we're going to ask you for a yes and story. So the idea here is an improvisation. You can't really get anywhere by saying no, and you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten when you're groups of people making something out of nothing, which is kind of what we all do every day. And I wonder if you've got something in your life, it could be work, it could be family, anything, where you had a yes and moment.
Well, it's such a sweet question. I mean, I can think of a lot all across the sectors, eras of my life. One that stands out to me that my wife and I have now used as sort of a shorthand. Back in 2010, I was advising one of my students when he was Prime Minister of Greece. George Papandreou, during the height of the economic crisis in Greece. That crisis emerged in 2009. He took office in, I think, October of 2009. And in March of 2010, we spent 2 weeks in Athens working with him and trying to help him figure out how to respond. And so one afternoon, we were walking through Athens. I'd been in Athens before, but I'd never had 2 solid weeks in Athens. We had a free afternoon. We were walking through Athens in a neighborhood that was a very beautiful neighborhood. It was before the economic collapse. So, you know, Athens was in really vibrant, great shape at the time. And there's an area of Athens near downtown Athens that's full of hills. Mm-hmm. And we happened to be walking all afternoon, and I was pretty tired out. You know, I'd been working a lot day and night, and I was pretty tired out. And we get to the street, and there's this big uphill, fairly steep set of red stairs. And my wife says, "God, those red stairs! We've got to take those red stairs. We've got to see what's up those red stairs." You know, and every bone in my body is saying, "No," you know, like we've had enough of a walk today. And she says, "No, we got to take these red stairs." So we took the red stairs. Of course, we took the red stairs. You know, and. And of course, at the top of the stairs, you know, was a whole other set of vistas, including a park and, you know, and a whole interesting set of areas that we then discovered, and my energy was renewed, and it was just fabulous. And so every time, you know, every time we get at that moment where, you know, one of us sees some opportunity and the other is inclined to say no, we say, you know, we say the red stairs, you know, the red stairs.
I love it. Climb the red stairs. That's its own metaphor. Ron Heifetz, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Kelly, great to meet you. Take care of yourself. Well, I've been working.